Good morning. I want to take some time today to tell you a sort of a narrative of this story about Jonathan and David. And sort of the catalyst for this was, is a few months ago, my son had a football tournament in Florida, and they asked me to speak. So I had to find some way to keep these football players' attention and talk to them about a story that was meaningful and that would always point us to Christ. So we're going to take some time today to look at that story. So I've been told maybe at least once or twice that I looked like some famous movie director or something like that. Somebody's told me that before. And when I go to California, I always get these strange looks when I'm riding public transportation. When I'm on the BART or something, people look at me like, are things bad for him? I mean, he's having to take the bus now. And what's he riding the subway for? So anyway, I was using my imagination. I thought, well, what would happen if I was able to sneak on Skywalker's ranch and get an audience with his guys in their conference room and talk to them about a movie I wanted to make? I said, guys, I got a movie I want to make. It's a great story. It comes from the Bible. I mean, it would be an epic like Cecil B. DeMille. It would be a great story like that. And the great thing about this story is we could make it in a trilogy, because I know how much you guys like trilogies. So we're going to make this into a trilogy, and we're going to start out with the first story from David the Shepherd to Giant Killer. And that's volume one. And volume two is going to be Giant Killer to King. And then the last volume we'll make, and we'll clean up on this one in the trilogy, is Good to Be King. That's my pitch there. So I want to talk to you about those three things. Now, but I want to talk to you especially about the second movie, because I think it's probably a part of David's life that people may not know a whole lot about. And so I want to talk to you about some of the high places and some of the details about that story. I wanted to start at the beginning of the end of the first movie. So we're going to take a look. If you look at your Bible in 1 Samuel 18, if you'll take a look there. And this is a movie poster from the first movie here. Rally in the Valley. This is about David and challenging the Goliath, and see giants real big and David's real small. So this would be the end of the very first movie. So let me read those verses. Let's start. We're going to go before that. We're going to look at 1 Samuel 17 at the very end of that, right before we get into 18, okay? So we're going to look at, if you back up just a little bit, in 1 Samuel 17, verse 55. Let's read those last few verses from that chapter. As soon as Saul David go out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, Abner, whose son is this youth? And Abner said, as your soul lives, O king, I do not know. And the king said, inquire whose son the boy is. And as soon as David returned from striking down the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul in the head of Philistine in hand. So David was making sure nobody got his trophy. I thought this was unusual. He had the giant's head still in his hand. And Saul said to him, whose son are you, young man? And David answered, I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite. So here's what I'm thinking about the first scene of the second movie. If we take a look at that. So this scene here is like Lawrence of Arabia. In fact, I stole it from Lawrence of Arabia. But imagine scene one is David riding on a camel or donkey, and he's got his trophy with him, and he's got the giant's head, which is the trophy, strapped to the back of it, and it's on one of these camels here in the very back. So I want to make sure we kept this PG today, so I didn't show you the giant's head. I want to make sure you guys didn't have to see that. But there are some famous artist renditions of that. I thought I would spare you. So this is the first scene of this great giant killer coming in to meet the king. And so now we're going to take a look at where we go from here. Now, the interesting thing about this is that David had been an armor bearer, and he had played for the for Saul, but evidently Saul didn't remember him until he killed a giant. So let's take a look at that chapter 18. That chapter 18 where we're looking at, and it says, when we look at this, is that we see Jonathan and David. His first chapter says, as soon as he finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit with the son, with the soul of David. Jonathan loved him as his own soul, and Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. So here it is, Jonathan and David are making a covenant with one another. And there's really only three reasons, or there's at least three reasons you'd make a covenant. In today's language, you would make a covenant because of love. So you see that with marriages. You see that with brotherly love. People would have a contract just for the purposes of doing business, quid pro quo, vis-a-vis type contracts. And then a merger. And so usually when a merger is, we have a weaker company would merge with a larger company. You see companies take over and stuff. So these were the sort of the three common covenants you would see back in the day of ancient times, even in the first century. And so we see Jonathan and David this time wanted to make a covenant with each other. We continue in those verses on verse 4. It says, and Jonathan stripped himself of his robe that was on him and gave it to David and his armor and even his sword and his bow and his belt. And David went out and was successful wherever Saul sent him. So that Saul sent him over the men of the army. This was good in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. So we see this covenant. We see David. The idea with the covenant is that you would exchange armor. You would exchange your breastplate. You'd exchange your belt and that kind of thing. But we see that with Jonathan because he's the son of a king. He's a son of a warrior, so he has these things. David's a shepherd. David's got a slingshot and a handful of rocks. But we see here in this covenant of brotherly love here, is we see when we make these exchange, what they are saying is that my enemies are your enemies, and your enemies are my enemies, and my strength is your strength is my strength. So that's this process that you see here. They're talking in these verse 4 through 5 or 6 here. Those are verses, and that's that process of the covenant, is that they're taking on with each other. So as we go through this narrative, we continue to see that as we read through chapter 18, we see that Saul gets jealous because Saul hears somebody singing. Saul has killed his thousands, David his 10,000s. So Saul is a little bit insecure, you might say. Saul takes offense to this. He thinks that he's afraid the popularity of David is going to take over. And so he doesn't take too kindly to this. So what Saul does in the back of his mind, he's thinking of ways he can get rid of David. And one of those ways is that he says, I'm going to have David, I'm going to offer him my oldest daughter. So it was a practice in the time, if you were a great warrior or a conqueror, or you wanted to marry the king's daughter and stuff, is that you would try to find families that were of the same social value and the same status, and there would be a great exchange for the bride. You'd marry the king's daughter, and you'd offer him your cattle, land, whatever you had. David didn't have anything. So when the king suggests that he marries his oldest daughter, and I don't know if she was homely or not, David didn't take too kind to that. So David said, who am I that you would consider me worthy enough to be your son-in-law? And so he sort of brushes that off. But later on, one of Saul's daughters says that he loves David, and he ends up marrying her, and her name is Michal. Michal, something like that. And so he marries her, and so now he is the son-in-law of the king. And in order for him to marry that, he said, I have nothing to offer the king. And the king says, well, bring me evidence you've killed 100 Philistines. And so David goes out, and he kills 200 Philistines. So I think that shows that he kind of liked the girl. So David went out there and did his fighting. So we see that they have this relationship with Saul. And we see that Saul is trying to get rid of David either through murder or through war or through some type of way, assassination or something. And we see this, we see that David's covenant with Jonathan is that Jonathan steps up, he feeds David information, he gives him intelligence so they can't catch him, that type of thing. So we see through this thing is that I got allergies, got a drink, so can still talk today. So, but we see that Saul confides in the servants, and Jonathan tell him that he wants to find a way to get rid of David, and Jonathan protects him. So we see that in chapter 19. And then in chapter 20, we see that David and Jonathan renew their covenant. It was not that there was anything wrong with the first covenant, but they were just reiterating, reestablishing that. I think also in chapter 24, we see that. So we see this idea that Jonathan is going to protect David throughout this process, and that's what happens. In chapter 21, you know, David went out and he took care of some more Philistines, and he was successful as he goes out in war, and his reputation grew bigger and bigger, and Saul's grew smaller and smaller, and he took offense to that. And David and Jonathan come up with a scheme of how to communicate with each other and run an intel. And so David actually sort of becomes a fugitive. He goes to Nod and tells the priest Ahimelech that he has got a secret mission. He lies to Ahimelech, and he tells him that he has this special mission and that he needs some provisions, and he needs Goliath's sword, so he needs to go out and protect him. So the priest accommodates him and gives him this stuff. David flees to the Philistines to Achish, the king of Gath. Now, David was a young man, but to go back to the Philistines after you'd killed their giant probably was not the brightest thing that he did. So he talks to King Achish, and he thinks he gets into a situation that he shouldn't be in. He says, I got to get out of this. And like Hamlet and Shakespeare, he has to act like a crazy guy, acts like he's mad. And the king says, we got plenty of mad men, let's get rid of them. So he sort of works his way out of that deal and that. So that would be a great scene there that we would see David acting like a madman. Then we get to verse 22. And this is where David escapes. He's being pursued by Saul again. He escapes to this cave in Adullam. And his brother and family finds out, and his brother and his house heard about it, and they went down to meet him. And it goes to show, even if you're living in a cave, your family will come find you. So, you know, you can't even hide from your family. David was hiding in a cave, and his family came and looking for him. He probably had to feed him. No telling what David had to do. So David gathers up an army of these discontented malcontents, if you will. He had about 400 to 600 of them. And he sent his parents to the king of Moab to protect them. And then he keeps going, and the king summons Ahimelech, or Saul summons him. And Saul finds out that he has helped David. He doesn't realize that David has lied to him, but through this action, Saul sort of takes offense to that. He kills all the priests. He kills many of the prophets and many of the people that are supposed to give him spiritual guidance. Saul wipes them all out. So that's in chapter 22. And then David goes to fight the Philistines in Keilah. And as he goes to Keilah, oops. And I did want to tell you that as he was staying in that cave, I think this is the one. Nope, we got it coming up here. We got a great scene coming up here. So David goes, fights these folks here. And Keilah, and David flees to the hill country of Ziph, and he escapes Saul's capture. So Saul is trying to pursue him, and David's trying to outrun him. Saul takes 3,000 of his chosen people, and he goes out, and he's chasing David. And Saul goes into this cave in which David and his men are hiding, and the men advise David to kill him. He said, David, God is handed Saul over to you today, you need to go kill him. And David would not do that. He would only cut off part of his robe, showing that he had given mercy to the king and spared his life. Because David saw that Saul was God's anointed because he was. Samuel anointed Saul. And so he saw Saul as one of his anointed, and he didn't think it was his job to kill Saul. He figured that was God's job. So David would not strike down the anointed, even though those around him said, it's what you need to do. Saul finally comes to his senses for a little while, not for long, but he admits that David admits that he's been unjust to David, that David's done nothing wrong, and that he has been evil in David, and knows David will be king one day. And Saul makes David pledge that he will show mercy to his household. So here's another scene to where the enemy is placed within your hands. You have within your sights that you can get rid of your enemies, and you think you can get rid of all your problems, and David doesn't do that. And David feels like he's ill-advised. So Saul cries out and says, you know, maybe I am wrong. Maybe God's hand is on your life, and I've done you an injustice. And here we see Saul pleads for him to show mercy to his family. This is going to come up later on when we get to 2 Samuel. So I find it interesting that even in these early verses, we see that Saul recognized David as somebody special and somebody that he does not want to forget him and to have him. So we continue to look at this, and we see another time when we get to chapter 26 is that David is staying in the land of Ziph, Z-I-P-H, and David has been set up again. They are telling Saul where David is, and they're hoping that they can get him. Achish finds favor with David and gives him the land of Ziklag to stay in for 16 months. But before then, what we see is that Saul tries to catch up with David again. Saul is camping out. He's got these 3,000 guys that are going to scout out David. They're going to pick David up and get rid of David. But David sneaks into the camp that night with his commander. And he's standing over Saul, who's asleep. And the commander says, this God has handed him into your hand again. You need to kill him. And David said, no, this is God's anointed. So David steals his spear and his water bottle. Now, David had learned something over the few years, and he waited until he was on the other side of the valley to call out to Saul because he didn't want to get into a fight with him. And so he cries out for Paul to have mercy. He tries to get Saul from pursuing him and stuff. But David will show mercy again, a second time to Saul when he had him in his hand. And then David works with King Achish from the Philistines, and he finds a land to stay in. He stays in Ziklag, and this sort of keeps him out of off of Saul's map for a little while, so he can sort of set up his folks there and take care of things. And that's chapter 28. So as we go to 29, we see that the Philistines are getting ready to fight the Israelites. So now Paul's in a predicament. Paul has sort of hedged his bets that he can go live in the land of the Philistines, that he can work on some of these outside tribes and villages and fight with them, but he won't have to fight Israel. Well, that's not the case. So we see in 1 Samuel 29 that the fight with Israel starts coming up. And David thinks like, well, I'm going to have to fight my own tribe. And so David gets his troops ready. And David gets his companies ready. And the commander of the Philistines questions Achish's choice of using David's army. So let's take a look at 1 Samuel 29. Let me read these first verses. Now, think about this. You're going to have to go up and fight against your brother, similar to maybe the Civil War, or fight against your own people. So here's what happens in this situation. Now, the Philistines had gathered all the forces of Aphek, and this is 1 Samuel 29. And the Israelites were encamped by the spring of Jezreel, as the Lord of the Philistines were passing on by hundreds and by thousands, And David and his men were passing on in the rear with Achish, the commanders of the Philistines, said, who are these Hebrews? What are these Hebrews doing here? And Achish said to the commander, is this not David, the servant of Saul, king of Israel, who has been with me not for days or years, who has been with him for days and years, and since he deserted to me, I have found no fault in him this day. But the commanders of the Philistines were very angry with him, and the commanders of the Philistines said to him, send the men back, that he may return to the place where he had been assigned, and he shall not go with us to battle, lest in the battle he become an adversary for us. For how could the fellow reconcile himself to the Lord? Would it not be with the heads of the men here? Is not this David of whom they sing, Saul has struck down thousands, and David is 10,000s? So we go through the scenarios that David gets rejected. Is that the Philistines don't want David to have anything to do with this fight because he thinks he's an insurgent and he's going to turn on him at some strategic point in a battle. So he says, you got to turn back, you got to go back to Ziklag, and you're going to go back to the land where you're at. So we think that's the end of the story. Well, God spares David from having to fight his own people. But what happens when he's away from Ziklag is another story. Is they had set up Ziklag as their town. They had their wives and their children in that town. And while they were gone, the Amalekites came in, and they took all their stuff, raided the town. They took all the wives and all the children and took them away and burned down the village. So basically, Saul took all the folks that were in his army, left his village unprotected, and they came in and swooped away. So now we have another dilemma here in this story. So that was they took them 3 days to go back to their village. The Amalekites had burned it all down. The Amalekites had sacked and captured everyone. And David prays to the Lord and tells him, and the Lord tells him to pursue him. And David finds the Amalekites celebrating with their pillage. And David overtakes them, recovers all that they have taken from them and all that they had stolen along the way. And David returns with it back to Ziklag. So here we see in the last chapter of 1 Samuel, we see the Philistines fighting the house of Israel. And we see the Philistines are overtaking the village of Mount Gilboa. That's where they're fighting at. And as they take that over, they come and they kill three of Saul's son, Abinadab, Melchishua, and Jonathan. I can spell one of those names, and I can only say one of those names. So we see that they kill three of Saul's son. Remember, Jonathan is the one who made the covenant with David. And Saul asked for his armor bearer to strike him down, but he won't do it because he sees him as God's anointed. And David falls on his own sword. And David dies there. So they all die on this mountain, Gilboa. The Philistines go and take their body and put them on display as they did in the old days. The Israelites came and recovered the bodies and went and buried them under a tree in the tamarack tree in Jabez and fasted for 7 days of mourning. So we see this climax where David comes to fight the Israelites. They don't let him fight, send him back to their village. Their village is burned down, so David's got that going on. And as David's doing that, the Philistines are overtaking the Israelites in Mount Gilboa, and they've killed the king. And they've killed some of the king's son. And so we see that at the end of 1 Samuel 31. So we're going to have to talk to the editors and the directors and stuff because it's going to be tough making this a PG-13 film. There's lots of killing going on here. So we'll see what we can do with that. But now I want to take you to 2 Samuel. I want to take you to 2 Samuel and take a look at what goes on in there. So we're about halfway through the story now. We're about halfway of seeing the redemptive work of Christ here. But David receives a report of the death of Saul and Jonathan. And David avenges the Amalekites. And David laments and mourns the loss of the king and his friend Jonathan. In verse 19 in 2 Samuel 1, it says, "You glory, O Israel," says, "your glory, O Israel, is slain on your high places, how the mighty have fallen." So it talks about the death of King Saul here. So David didn't have to lift an arm against the Israeli army or against the Israelites. But we see things sort of shifting. We see power shifting. We go to 2 Samuel 2. And David goes to Judah, to the city of Hebron, as directed by the Lord. And Abner, which is Saul's commander, makes Saul's son, Ish-bosheth, we'll call him Ish, he makes King Ish, the son, who is the son of Saul, and makes them king over Israel. And then Israel and David's army fight, and Abner kills Ashiel with a sword. And this was Joab's brother. And so being a good brother, he tries to avenge Abner, who's Saul's commander. And in this skirmish that we see with David, is that David and the tribes of Saul are fighting one another. We see that David strikes down 360 in this skirmish, and the Israelites only 20. And we see that Joab has killed Ashiel, and he has placed him in his father's tomb. So here we get to chapter 3 in 2 Samuel, and we see a long war between the house of Saul and the house of Israel. We see the house of Saul and the house of David. And as we see this, we see that the house of David gets stronger, and the house of Saul is starting to fall. So we see that coming about. That's sort of the tension we see in these scenes here. We see the commander of Saul, as Abner gets in a disagreement with the new king, Saul's son. And Abner says that he's going to go make alliances with David. So Abner goes over, he meets with David, and he works with David to seal a deal. And there's one thing that David requests, and I think it's in this chapter, is remember David married Saul's daughter, his second daughter. And so David, when he cuts this deal with Abner, the commander, who's turned against the house of Saul and come to the house of David, they're trying to make a peaceful transition and make a covenant. Abner had talked to the elders of the Israel, and they had agreed to it. And they had worked out the details. It looked like there was going to be a peaceful transfer of power. And what David does, he asks for Michal, his first wife, who was not with him any longer because of his having to flee from Saul. And that was probably more of an act of showing that he was part of Saul's house also as a son-in-law to Saul. So he asked to bring her back and puts that into place. So as we see all this happening, we think, all right, finally the movie's going to end because we're going to have a peaceful transfer of power. Oh, no, it's not going to happen. We see Joab kills Abner to avenge the death of his brother. And so we think Abner and David have worked out a deal where they are going to have peaceful transfer, and that doesn't happen. And Joab kills to avenge his brother's death. And that kills the deal, and David mourns the death of Abner. Meanwhile, we have some other guys that are captains in Saul's army, and they kill Saul's son, and they bring the head of this guy to David and saying, look what we have done. We have taken over. And Saul gets rid of those two guys because they have they've cut a deal. And so Saul gets rid of those guys. We're seeing in chapter 5 of 2 Samuel that David is anointed king of all Israel in Hebron. And David was 30 years old when he reigned at Judah. He reigned in Judah for 7 years, and then he reigned over Israel for 33 years. And David and his army overtook Jerusalem and established his kingly rule from the city of David, from the gately city. So now David has moved from Hebron to Jerusalem. And now David is ready to set up house. So it's taken David about seven and a half years to get from Hebron to Jerusalem. to take over what was left of Saul's house. So now he's in Jerusalem. There's a scene here where they have the Ark of the Covenant, and they want to move the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem. And Uzzah was struck dead because as they were moving the Ark, it was falling, and he reached out to touch him, and he was struck dead. And this scared David. The instructions for moving the Ark was to move it by hand, and they were using an oxen cart, so they had not obeyed God in that. So David was part of it was he was scared. I think part of it was mad. So out of fear, David puts the Ark in this guy's house, in Obed-Edom's house. So he puts it there in that house. And then in that house, he's in there for about 3 months. Well, this guy's house is blessed. He's blessed beyond all blessings in this 3 months that the Ark of the Covenant is there. You know, somebody ought to do a movie about this. That would be a good thing, too, if you could think about maybe doing a movie about the Ark. But anyway, so David moved the Ark finally after about 3 months to the city. And David was offering peace offerings and burnt offerings before the Lord. And David got approval to build God's house. You know, the Ark of the Covenant had been in this tent and this tabernacle, and now David was going to build this glorious house for him. So he gets permission through his prophet Nathan that would be a good thing. And David restores the house of Israel. And then we're finally getting to the climax of the movie here. In 2 Samuel 8, David's victories are reviewed. And David sort of sets up his government here. He assigned various officers and that kind of deal. And then I wanted to get to now, David is sort of getting his house in order, okay? David's done all this fighting. He's finally gotten to take over the skirmish that was Saul's house. And he's brought the whole house of Israel back together. They're back in Jerusalem. And now David has set his house up. And now I want to bring you to the attention of 2 Samuel 9. So hopefully I hadn't lost any of you yet. Well, there's a two of you I've lost, I see, but maybe the rest of you are still with me. So it takes a lot to put a movie together. But here's the climax of the movie. Here's the crux of the story I want to get to. And since we had an extra hour, do we get an extra hour today? Does anyone have to finish an hour earlier or get an extra hour to preach? I'm not sure what that means. But anyway, let's take a look at this chapter, 2 Samuel 9. Now, I'm proud to have my son with me today, Jonathan David. His name is Jonathan David because I didn't know how to say or spell Mephibosheth. But we're going to talk about Mephibosheth. And Mephibosheth is Jonathan's grandson. And when all this fighting was going on in the house of Saul, when we see the Philistines take over, is the servant of Mephibosheth, when he's about 4 or 5, is taking him out of the house, trying to evade being captured or killed, and drops Mephibosheth, and Mephibosheth is crippled in both feet now. So that's who we're going to talk about. So let's take a look at 2 Samuel chapter 9. And David said, "Is there still anyone left in the house of Saul that I may show kindness for Jonathan's sake?" This goes back to the covenant that David and Jonathan did a long time ago. And so now he's looking to show mercy to the house of Jonathan. But remember also, in one of those things where David had spared Saul's life, is Saul said, "Show kindness to the house of Saul." Because it was routine when a king would take power over like David did, whoever they took power from is they would go find that house and they would kill everybody that was from that line of folks. So when David asked, "Are there anybody left in the house of Saul?" what an ordinary person would think is that he's going to go get rid of all these people. Now he finishes that statement up, "So that I may show kindness to Jonathan." And let's look at verse 2. "Now there was a servant in the house of Saul whose name was Ziba. And they called him to David, and the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" And he said, "I am your servant." And the king said, "Is there not still anyone in the house of Saul that I may show kindness of God of him?" And Ziba said to the king, "There is still a son, Jonathan. He is crippled in his feet." The son said to him, "Where is he?" And Ziba said to the king, "He is in the house of Machir, the son of Ammiel, at Lodabar." Now, Lodabar was basically a desert place. If you've been to Israel, there's lots of sand and desert over there. So I would assume that Ziba and Jonathan are out hiding in the desert. So it's probably not a place most people go by. And so they found this place to hide out in. And in verse 9 it says, "Then King David went and brought him from the house of Machir and the house of Ammiel at Lodabar. And Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David and fell on his face and paid homage. And David said, 'Mephibosheth,' and he answered, 'Behold, I am your servant.' And David said to him, 'Do not fear, for I will show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. And I will restore to you all the land of Saul, your father, and you shall eat at the table at my table always.' And he paid homage to him." So I'm sure that Mephibosheth comes before David thinking like, well, this is the end of it. David's going to wipe us all out. He's going to wipe out all the servants. He's going to wipe out anybody that has anything to do with the house of Saul and get rid of them. So he's hoping to do this. So what we see here is we see David showing mercy. And if we pick this up, here's his response. "What is it, your servant, that you should show regard, for I am a dead dog such as I?" Then the king called Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, "All that belonged to Saul and to all the house I will give to your master's grandson, and you and your sons and your servants shall still till the land for him and shall bring in the produce, and your master's grandson may have bread to eat. But Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, shall always eat at my table." So we see this story where we think Mephibosheth thinks this is the end of his life, and this is really where his life begins. So here's the last scene. I've got the first scene. Here's my last scene right here. Here's the last scene that we see here with Mephibosheth. So this is the end of the movie. And it says, "So Mephibosheth ate at the king's table like he was one of the king's sons." We see that at the at verse 11 in there. So we go through this whole story today to hear about David. And so if I was a good preacher, the question that you would have to answer would be, what's that got to do with the redemptive work of Christ? Was there any bloodshed for this sermon to be preached? So that's the question to ask. So what does this story do for us? This story does point to the redemptive work of Christ. If we look up here at the king's table, David demonstrates God's mercy on the helpless. We are spiritually crippled like Mephibosheth. As far as I could tell, Mephibosheth was the last living descendant of Saul. And we see that God shows mercy to him. We see that God has chosen to save us, not because of our work, but because of Christ's work on the cross. We are guests at the king's table by invitation because of a relationship to Christ, who is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Our lives are restored because of the work of Christ. He restores a year that the locusts have eaten. We are considered a royal chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people of God's own choosing, who has called us out of the darkness into his marvelous light. Excuse me. God demonstrates his love to us while we were still sinners. He died on the cross for us. So we see in the story of David the redemptive work of Christ. We see him that God has made a promise, and Jesus is the guarantee. As son and daughters, we are benefactors of this promise. We become part of the kingdom because of the life, death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. We live with him forever because he is a perfect sacrifice and his first resurrection and Son of God. So today, as I invite you to the invitation, we have an invitation for folks that want to enter the ministry or become a missionary. We have folks that need to go to the King's table and maybe pray. If you just need to come and pray, rededicate your life to the Lord, that's what these altars here are for. And then if today is your day of salvation, if you've been in the desert of Lodabar, God invites you to eat at the King's table. God invites you to come here and eat with the King because of the work of Christ. If you're a Christian and it's been too long that you've eaten at the King's table, I invite you too also to come to these altars and eat at the King's table.